And welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with all those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, sound editors, sound mixers, composers, editors, VFX gurus, and so many more. You name it, we talk to them. And we're going to be doing some talking today. Looking forward to today's show. You are going to get to hear on today's show, I mentioned it last week, my exclusive interview with Barry Pepper, which I'll get to in a moment. Plus, writer, director, actor Jeff Knight will be joining us at the midpoint of the show to talk about his new film, the horror film, The Omicron Killer. And if you're thinking Omicron, COVID, yes, you're absolutely right in the context. This is actually a follow-up to his last film, The COVID Killer. But it's more lethal than COVID or the Omicron variant. But there's a lot of metaphor that's tied in there, and I'm looking forward to speaking with Jeff about that. So, we're counting it down. Sunday, the Oscars. You know, this year's Oscars, you've noticed, I have not spoken about them. It's very lackluster, as far as I'm concerned this year. Very lackluster. I question a lot of the nominees, and also some of the omissions. But I think Oppenheimer is going to be the big winner next week on Sunday night. So we shall see, and maybe we'll talk about it next Monday. But a lot of wonderful, small, independent films are out right now. Last week, we talked about one of them, Red Right Hand from the Nelms Brothers. I'm telling you again, if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's especially if you like their work with Fat Man with Mel Gibson a couple years ago. You're going to like Red Right Hand. And of course, Air Force One Down is now out. It is still in some theaters. It is also on VOD. Even Spectrum has it, and digital. And it's a fun action film. There's a new one coming out this Friday. The Accidental Texan. What a charmer. A charmer. It stars Thomas Hayden Church, Rudy Pankow, Carrie Ann Moss, Bruce Dern, and Eddie the Cow. The cutest eyes in the world on this cow. But it is absolutely charming. I spoke with Mark Bristol, who was the director. It's only his second feature. The last film that he directed was in 1999. You'll be hearing my interview with Mark later this week. It'll be up on BehindTheLensOnline.net. And I may air it next week, on next week's show. As well. We shall see. But it is light, bright, it's uplifting. It's got some great father-son themes in it. The whole forgiveness, redemption. But as I said, the highlight of the film, Eddie the Cow. And of course, Bruce Dern, whose character of Schiermeier owns Eddie the Cow. Watching Bruce with a cow is well worth the price of admission for this film. But it makes you feel good. Accidental Texan. We'll talk more about that next week. Or you'll find out more on BehindTheLensOnline.net this week. Before I forget, I want to remind everybody, if you are in the LA area and you want to taste some of this great LTC, all natural beef jerky, that I've been talking about for a few months, head on over to Mom's Bar on Santa Monica Boulevard in Santa Monica, and you can pick it up there. I keep waiting to find out from the owner and manufacturer, Marcus Tiggs. I keep waiting to find out when is it going to expand to other areas. Or if you're in Columbia, you can get it in Columbia right now. So if you're planning any trips south of the border, you can pick up LTC, All Natural Beef Jerky in Columbia. Otherwise, just hop on over to Mom's Bar, and you can get yourself some there along with some really good drinks, and, you know, a really fun time. So, we are going to, today you're going to get to hear my interview with Barry Pepper. I have long just loved Barry Pepper and his work. He is one of those underrated actors. Really, he is, you can classify him as a character actor. Decades from now, you know, in today's world, we look back on guys like Barry Fitzgerald or Thomas Mitchell or Dame Mae Whitty from the golden age of film, Mary Wicks, Eve Arden, and they're all deemed character actors. That is the category that I would put Barry Pepper in for this generation. Although he is fully capable of being a leading man, he is chameleonic in his roles that he takes. I have just been enamored with him and his performances since early in his career. We Were Soldiers, he plays Joe Galloway in that, opposite Mel Gibson. Talks about the first offensive in the Vietnam War. It's an incredible film if you haven't seen it. Barry is excellent. The Green Mile, opposite Tom Hanks, one of the guards there. Maze Runner, Kill the Messenger. Fabulous film, once again. Snitch, which he did with Rick Roman Waugh. Trigger Point, which he's excellent. Crawl, which he really did step up to leading man status as a father with a daughter and during a hurricane, and there are all the alligators. Of course, you could call the alligators the leading actors in that. But, and then, of course, one of my all-time favorite films of Barry's, Bitter Harvest, which, and you're going to hear him talk a little bit about Bitter Harvest in this interview. It really is, it shows us how the current socio-political events of the world today, history repeats itself. And unfortunately, when history is repeating itself, it's not in a good way. If you haven't seen Bitter Harvest, see it. He is also currently in Lawman Bass Reeves. He plays Esau Pierce. And of course, his new film, Bring Him to Me. Bring Him to Me, it's out now. It's on digital. It's on VOD. I think it's still, it's in some theaters. But he plays Driver. He's quiet. He's introspective. Which, if you know Barry Pepper's work, you know that's a trademark quite often of his characters. They are quiet. They're purposeful. They are introspective. It's one reason I want to see him and Steve Burton of General Hospital at some point team up in a project together. I think they would be fantastic because Steve also is very introverted. He's a man of few words with the characters that he has played, especially his legendary character of Jason Morgan on General Hospital, which he is back in action today. After a several-year absence, he is back on the docket. So, all you GH fans, I know you've already got a DVR and you're going to see it. But that's a pairing I want to see one day, is Barry and Steve. But in Bring Him to Me, Driver is working for a mob boss. The mob boss is played by Rachel Griffiths. And his conscience is tested when he is asked to collect a young and suspecting new crew member known as Passenger, played by Jamie Costa, just 1 week after a violent robbery at a pawn shop run by Sam Neill that does essentially money laundering for the mob. However, Passenger doesn't know the real purpose in Driver picking him up and taking him to an unknown location. There is an ambush afoot, and it really creates a crisis of conscience for Driver, and forces him into a moral dilemma and challenges his own integrity. And much of the film takes place inside a 1970 Chevelle Super Sport with a 454 engine that Barry got to drive in the entire film. So the car becomes a character as well, but everything takes place within the car. So you're limited in movement, and so much of what we see and understand in this film comes from Barry's facial expressiveness, his reaction to things that the nonstop chatterbox passenger keeps saying. And when you watch the film, even down to Driver's hands, how they're gripping the steering wheel, speaks volumes as to what he is internalizing and his crisis of conscience. It's a really wonderfully done film. I have watched it twice. I watched it in the middle of the night again the other night at like 3 o'clock in the morning. And it just stays with you and you can't look away. And the reason is Barry's performance. Film is fast-paced. It's a thriller. It's taut. The tension builds and builds and builds. So, rather than listen to me prattle on, take a listen to my exclusive interview with the wonderful Barry Pepper, talking Bring Him to Me.
Hi, Barry. Hi, how are you?
I am beyond thrilled to be speaking with you. I have tried to speak with you countless times over the past 2.5 decades. And finally,
you know, it's funny for an actor. I'm pretty camera shy, so I'm a bit of a recluse. But I hope I haven't been dodging you.
No. It's just for a lot of the films, you weren't available or things like that.
Yeah.
So when I saw that you were available for this one, I jumped. Deanna will tell you. But I have admired your work since the very early days, since the very beginning. You bring something really unique to all of your characters. And in many cases, you are emotionally chameleonic in an introverted kind of way. And it's fascinating to watch your performances, Barry. I look at you in something like Bitter Harvest or in We Were Soldiers, which is so observational, but in that case, we're seeing it through Joe Galloway's eyes of what's unfolding. And Take Us Into the Green Mile or Kill the Messenger. And of course, what you did with My Pal Rick with Snitch is wonderful. Yeah. So, I mean, it has been such...
That's so very kind. Isn't it interesting, when we were in the Ukraine filming Bitter Harvest, that was when the first invasion took place, and we were actually ushered out of there before things really kicked off, because we were not very welcome in terms of the story we were telling there. Just fascinating to think of being there at that time and now what's happening.
Yeah.
So tragically, Ukraine now. Anyway, sorry.
No, but like, and with Bitter Harvest, I spoke with Max about the film, and he was, I think it's one of the biggest experiences he had had at that point, really. He was just grasping the socio-political situation at that time. But yeah, to see history repeat itself, never a good thing in these kind of cases. But it's because of the work that you do and the stories you tell that really open people's eyes, such as with The Green Mile or We Were Soldiers. So many people didn't really know what transpired in Nam and what was happening back in the States at Fort Benning. And then to see you in a film like Crawl, which was just a kick in the ass and fabulous.
Yeah.
And now...
That was so much fun. Oh. I try to do films like that for my daughter. You know, those are just fun. And I had such a blast doing that. And it did really well for them. I think we shot it on 15 or 13.5 million, and it made 100 million worldwide. I think you know, people enjoyed it just as a popcorn crunching, you know, creature feature. So it was great fun switching like that.
I'm not going to tell you how many times I've watched it. It has been many times. It's one of those go-to films at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, sure.
And it's great. And now to see you in Driver, as Driver, and Bring Him to Me. Wow. Number one, I am so jealous that you got to drive that 1970 Super Sport.
Yeah.
I have to start with you in the car, with Driver and the car. This is a real bonding experience. The car is a character.
Yeah, very much so. When Luke first sent me the script, that's what struck me as well. The car really has its own identity, and it's like this third character, this fire-breathing dragon that they're riding to their demise, and it acts as a catalyst to bond Driver and passenger, as you know, the car allows these themes of fatherhood and morality and family bonds to come to the surface that otherwise wouldn't.
How much of the driving did you get to do yourself?
I did all of it.
Oh my God.
Yeah, we had under $3 million and 16 days to shoot it. 16 days. So anybody who has, you know, never made an independent movie has no idea what an insane challenge that is.
Yeah.
I normally don't ever bring up the challenge of filmmaking. We're so blessed to do this for a living, but this one was particularly fast and furious. I mean, 16 days is absolutely insane schedule for an action-heavy, character-driven crime thriller. We had nothing in the budget for a stunt driver. But years ago, I had the pleasure of playing Dale Earnhardt in a film called Three, and that was a NASCAR film, and I went to Lowe's Motor Speedway to race school and got to drive these 700 horsepower 200 mile an hour race cars around the track for a week or so, and so when I met Luke and he asked me if I could drive, I said, I think I can handle it.
Yeah, it comes back to you. It's like a muscle memory, I think. And plus, you were doing the bulk of this film was all night shoots as well. And you had rain. I mean, there wasn't a lot of fake stuff, but you had weather involved here, too. So, no, a budget like that, it does not give any wiggle room for things like stunt people when you have an actor who can execute brilliantly what is needed.
I mean, it was so enjoyable, as you say, to drive the car. It was such a pleasure. I had a 65 GTO for a lot of years and ended up selling that. Just didn't seem like the right choice for my LA daily driver. I missed that car. I loved it so much, and so it was a real treat to drive the Chevelle for sure.
Oh my God! Yeah, I'm very jealous of that. Let me tell you. Talk to me about when you got this script. I mean, this is the first time that Luke is directing a script written by somebody else. Here it's written by Tom Evans. He normally directs his own properties. What were your thoughts on this one? Because this is a very unique story. There's, especially with your character, there is a lot of mystery, ambiguity, anonymity as to purpose and background. But this also leads to, and this is where you really excel with your body language and facial expressiveness, Barry. We see a crisis of conscience developing in Driver. We see him realizing the moral dilemma that he is now going to be facing as we build into that third act and what goes down. So I'm curious, you know, you get a script like this, written by Tom, Luke's going to be directing it. Do you remember what your thoughts were when you read this one? Is this the kind of script that you jumped at or took some pause and thought about it?
It was interesting how it came about. I was just inspired by his Occupation Rainfall franchise and was just amazed at what he was able to do with tight budget. And so we had reached out to him and just, you know, said if there was anything that we could maybe collaborate on. And we fun to start that dialogue. And he had sent me a script that we weren't able to get off the ground for whatever reason. And then David Oyelowo called me about a year before he was developing Bass Reeves and asked me if I would play opposite him in that project. So that sort of derailed Luke and I's adventure. And then Bass Reeves got pushed, and I called Luke back and said, you know, my project's been pushed, and is there a chance that we could, you know, put that film in that time slot? And he said, you know, I can't seem to get that going, but here's another script. And he sent me, bring him to me. And like you said, it was so different than what he had done before. And again, written by Tom Evans. But I was just struck by the background of what had inspired Tom to write it. I just loved that it was inspired by the Joe Pesci scene in Casino,
mm-hmm.
where he's driven cornfield, and that Tom was struck by the notion of what would that car ride be like? You know, a character unwittingly driven to their demise under false pretenses, and how would that go? And then he crafted these two uniquely contrasting characters in Driver and Passenger, and I just loved it that Driver was so, you know, held his cards so tight to his chest. He's obviously a pretty quiet and reserved and clearly damaged character, and that Passenger was just this effervescent, you know, young kid full of energy and ideas, and it was just so annoying to Driver to be stuck in the car with him. But as you say, as their ride together progresses, he's faced with this moral dilemma: deliver the passenger to his possible demise, or disobey the boss and face the dangerous consequences that will surely fall on his own family. And I was just fascinated by it. I read it a few times, and then I got back to Luke and said, you know, let's do this. And within 2 weeks, we were in pre-production. And 6 weeks from the time I called him back, we were filming. I mean, that just never happens. It's just,
wow.
Just the nature of Luke's Spark Films company. And it's a family-based company, his wife and his father and mother-in-law, and it's a family, a family-run company, and that they are able to work with such small budget but deliver, I think really quality products. And yeah, it was just amazing to me. That's why, you know, everybody else is out searching for financing, and he's able to just jump behind the camera and get going.
Mm-hmm.
I just love the themes of guilt and consequence and grief and addiction that the audience is aware of from the beginning, so you're intimately along for the ride, you know, relating to that same anguish that Driver is dealing with. Without revealing spoilers, it's so interesting how that relationship develops.
It's fascinating. Because, you know, Driver is a man of little words, while Passenger it's verbal diarrhea for him, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
That's Passenger. And then I love how cinematographer Ross Clarkson is able to capture your face and your facial responsiveness to this never-ending stream of nothingness coming out of Passenger's mouth. And, you know, I chuckled in a few spots because the pacing, Luke has the pacing on this cut so well. As you're watching the film and you're thinking, does this guy ever stop talking? So we are in your head with you.
Yeah.
And that really comes across because of, even though you're driving the car and you're paying attention and your hands are on the wheel, it doesn't stop your face from speaking volumes, or your hands from tightening more around the steering wheel, the more aggravated Driver is getting. And you bring those little touches. Now, something I'm curious about, Barry, because of the power of that car and you're driving it, because of the way it's shot and also in a cost cutting and all, I'm guessing that camera was riding right along with you as you're shooting.
There was times where he would be positioned in the back seat and then we would have rigs, but pretty much all of it was practical, which is
rare.
It's just extraordinary that we never wiped that car out. I mean, there was one scene where, of course, there's, you know, they're soaking the streets with water trucks constantly because we did have a lot of natural rain, and at that time of year, there was sort of their monsoon or wet season, and so we did have a lot of natural rain, but just screaming down those roads and then, you know, taking, you know, hairpin turns, and it was just a miracle that we never rolled a car. But there was one scene where I came sliding into a turn, and Jamie and I ended up in the fence.
Oh, God.
Not making my turn, but that was the only near miss that we had, and the car really didn't get a scratch on it, and but it was pretty intense, just even for me, because I'm at the wheel and I have it was a 1970 Chevelle, no seatbelts and early no airbags, and here's the young actor beside me that I have his life in my hands, and a cameraman in the back seat, and I'm, so your mind is racing for certain.
What at this stage, because I know Dion is texting me, I only have like 3 minutes left. Got to ask you, at this stage of your career, what is it that you look for in a script, in a role? Is it the character? Is it the director? What is the first threshold that you have, that a script has to meet when it comes your way?
You know, I had the good fortune of working with Tom Wilkinson a couple of times, Nick Benedict News, and then again in Lone Ranger. We became very good friends, and I asked him, I always ask these legendary actors like Tom Hanks or whomever I'm working with, you know, what is their best advice? And Tom, I'll never forget, he told me, when you read the script, ask yourself these three things. Do I believe it? Do I care? And will I go on caring? And I always think about that when I read a script, and I want to know, first of all, if I believe it, if I feel like I can make it believable for the audience. And do I even care about this subject matter? Is there any value in it? And will I go on caring, like a year later when I have to, talk about it and promote it? And that's always been a great advice for me. I feel like if it touches me emotionally, or I feel like a connection to it, in some emotional way, I think that I'm intrigued to continue reading, and then it really comes down to reading the script multiple times and then chatting with the director and the writer and clarifying beats and ideas that come up for me, like how important I felt the car was to driver and that I didn't want passenger to touch it or to mess it up or make it dirty. It was this precious. It was one of the only things the driver had left in the world, and so there are little beats like that that you discuss and you try to bring to the forefront, so it's kind of like a developing, evolving process, really. I mean, you can read it and love it, but then you got to make sure that you're really all going to be there to support each other, and you have the same vision through to the end of the production, because when I leave, I don't have any involvement in the edit,
right?
Or how it's going to be promoted. So I really, I think that's really, really important for me, is to work with people that I can have fun with, and also I think people that will not be turned off by my style of or how I like to work. So I don't know if I necessarily call myself method, because I try not to be a complete monster about staying in character, but on set I am. I stay in character. When I leave, we can go have dinner together. So it's not, full Daniel Day-Lewis. But I think it's sometimes off-putting for people if they're not used to working that way. But for me, I just haven't been able to find a better way of working. So it's not so much that I wish I could be more social, and I wish I could be more, easygoing and lighthearted and fun throughout a production like this. But that's very challenging, because I kind of want to live in the emotions of the characters.
Well, it's been working for you for the past 30 years, Barry, so you don't change a horse midstream when it's working.
Oh, it's so sweet of you to say all the kind things you have, and I really enjoy speaking to you again on the next one.
I sure hope we get to, Barry. This has been a joy, and thank you so, so much.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was the wonderful Barry Pepper talking about Bring Him to Me. And seriously, there is not a film that he's done that I wouldn't say go see it. If you haven't seen it, go see it. You see his growth as an actor. You see his choices. You see these great characterizations he brings. And Bring Him to Me. It's there now. Along with Lawman Bass Reeves on the small screen. So check it out. And now we're going to switch gears here and welcome the brains behind the Omicron killer, Jeff Knight. Hi, Jeff.
How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
This is quite an interesting little adventure you take us on here.
Yes.
Now, I had not seen the quote-unquote prequel, The COVID Killer, but that is not to say that's a bad thing, because you fill us in with the Omicron Killer. So if you haven't seen The COVID Killer, you bring us up to speed very quickly.
I did that on purpose because of two things. The COVID Killer was a really, really, really low-budget movie. So a lot of people didn't see it. And so I took a cue from the Rocky movies.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever watch the Rocky films, they recap the previous Rocky film at the beginning. So I said, I should just do that real quick so that you don't have to watch the previous film to understand this film.
And also, as the film progresses, throughout the dialogue, references are again made through story points,
such as your
necromancer. We get
yes.
more detail and depth that refers back to the COVID killer. So
yes, in flashbacks, yeah.
So we are never lost. You make sure that we are not lost.
Yeah, because I feel like every movie, even if it's part of a series, should stand alone.
Yeah, you should be. I mean, that is always a good rule of thumb, that even if
you should be able to watch the movie without watching the previous movie. If you did watch it, it should enhance the experience, but it should be able to be watched on its own.
Absolutely. Which now this begs the question, where did the idea for the COVID killer and subsequently the Omicron killer, where did this idea come from?
The COVID killer came from an idea during COVID when it first started. Everybody was wearing the masks. And I was in a bank, my bank, CEFQ. And I seen everybody wearing masks. And I'm like, wow. Like, when you watch movies about bank robberies, they usually come in real quick with the mask and then they rob the place. I'm like, I can get all the way up to the teller without them knowing that I could rob the place. So I was thinking, that's pretty scary. And not only that, on the street, anybody could walk up to you. You don't know who anybody is.
That's right.
You know, so then I started thinking, I can't make a bank robbery movie because that's too expensive, so I can make it into a horror film about a man who's just roaming the streets attacking people, you know?
And then with Omicron Killer, we jump ahead. Well, we jump ahead from COVID Killer, and now it's, he's a copycat serial killer.
Yeah, what happened was I never planned on making a copycat in the original movie. But I was working with another guy who helped me produce the movie, and I was having a hard problem with him. So I didn't like the film the way it was turning out, so I had to reinvent it halfway through. So mm-hmm. I came up with a copycat killer, and then I reshot the second half of the movie. And it actually helped me because I ended up with the Omicron.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I love how they just build on each other.
Yes. I'm trying to build, and it's going to build towards even bigger things.
Uh-oh. You know, I'm Crazy Clown. You've got this hilarious character, Crazy Clown, pops up.
Crazy Clowny, yeah.
there could be Crazy Clown in the future. We could have more Necromancer in the future.
Yes. Well, the next film is going to be, it's going to be a spinoff. It's going to be Crazy Clowny.
Oh my God.
That's the next film. And I like it because Crazy Clowny, he's to my knowledge, he's the only horror icon that breaks the fourth wall. So I think it'll be interesting making a movie with him where he gets to actually speak to the audience. You know,
That is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Freddy Krueger kind of did it, and he hint at it, but I feel like Crazy Clowny, he's going to be a wisecracking, kind of like Freddy Krueger type of character, but mm-hmm. he gets to speak directly to the audience, kind of like Deadpool, and I think that'll be a unique little thing, little premise, you know?
Well, that's one of the things I love with Omicron Killer, is that there is the dialogue, things do get crazy and campy with a lot of the dialogue. I just, it cracks me up when I get this, are you guys super stupid? you know, and I sit there and I'm laughing because these.
I wanted to make a fun movie. I wanted to make a movie like if you really watch the movie, it's kind of a throwback to the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, even my character's name, Brock Callahan, that's not a real name. That's a made up 80s name.
That could be your porn name. I just say, you know, those are the kind of names people were coming up with for characters then.
Yeah, so I wanted to make it seem like a nice, because I grew up in the 80s, you know, and that's my time, and we don't get those fun movies. Everybody's so serious with their movies. And I was like, I want to make a fun, just horror movie that you don't have to take it too seriously, but it is serious at the same time.
Well, and your whole the whole setup here, as people watch the film and we see our copycat serial killer, he ends up in a hospital. Nobody knows who he is. He doesn't talk to anybody. He's getting treated.
He's kind of the hero of the film. If you really watch the movie, he's almost the hero of the movie. Everybody treats him horribly.
Well, everybody except for Nurse Nancy.
Except for Nurse Nancy, yes.
And... You know, right here, I mean, Nurse Nancy, Bai Ling, the minute you know you have Bai Ling in the film, you know there's going to be something really funny happening.
No, and you know what's funny was that originally that wasn't in the film, in the script. She improvised that. Oh, she said, she came up to me, she goes, can I expand my role? I want to be in love with the Omicron. So we end up just doing that on set. That wasn't in the original screenplay. She wanted to be as Harley Quinn.
Oh my God! You know,
I guess for future roles, I guess she wanted to expand herself for the future, which now we're going to do that. So,
because you know, you've got our copycat serial killer, you have the Omicron killer. He is in the hospital. You've got a really strange doctor in there. You've got
Dr. Krueger. Everybody loves to hate him.
You've got a roommate in the sharing the room with the Omicron killer. And all he's known for is, you know, leaving a disgusting mess in the bathroom in the room. So everybody that goes to, like, search the room or look, they open the bathroom door and they hold their nose and it's like, oh, no. Nope. Goodbye.
What's going on in here?
So you throw in all of these little side gags.
Yes.
Throughout the film, and even yourself, as
yes.
as a police detective, as you know, Detective Brock Callahan, and his partner, and you know, responding to and in interactions with your captain, Captain Callahan, beautifully,
oh, yeah, I love her. She's
beautifully played by Lynn Lowry.
She's great, man.
She really is. And watching the two of you, because Brock is her son.
She acts like me.
She does.
She acts like it's like if I got my persona from her. We're both like kind of assholes, you know. And we detect we're like no nonsense cops.
Oh, absolutely. You call them like you see them.
Yes.
But watching the two of you and her whole attitude for everything, and it comes down to, you know, you see him, you walk up to him, you say this, and shoot him right between the eyes. And, you know, Brock is going, well, no, I can't say that. And then Brock's partner is going, well, no, you could say this. And then you've got these great looks, like, are you
insane?
Yeah,
they go off on this dancer, yeah.
Just the playfulness. But it's campy playfulness that really works and keeps the film light. Even with...
That's what I want. I wanted, I guess, like I said, I wanted a fun movie. Like Evil Dead. Yeah. The Evil Dead movies are so fun to watch, you know?
Well, and, you know, and that... I really like that aspect of this. I really like
that.
The aspect of this. And something else that you do, you have great kills in this movie. And
yeah, we had a girl. The girl that did it, she was great. We found her, and she was just starting out, and it ended up being, like, just a great... Luck was basically luck that we had.
Your special effects makeup by Jillian McCoy.
Jillian McCoy, she was great.
Is excellent. Excellent. But we're using, you know, a filed off, you know, tire iron and all kinds of fun things. And,
yeah.
You know, it's all done practically.
Yes, all of it is practical.
You know, how important is that to you? And was it for you in this film to do these stunts? Obviously, economically, you need to do them practically.
Yeah, we need to do them. But at the same time, it makes the movie more fun and more realistic. You know what I mean? Because, I mean, the movie's so campy, we don't want it to come off as a parody. So we need it to look realistic. The kills have to be realistic.
Mm-hmm. And every one of them truly is.
Yeah.
Every one of
and
them
is. And at the same time, I didn't want them too gory.
Right.
And they're not. You see blood, but there's no people getting torn to pieces. I like horror, but I'm not into too much gore.
You're not into Saw. You're not into the horror of Saw. That kind of.
I actually like the Saw movies, but I like them for the story.
But,
I bear through the gore.
But yeah, you really temper back. I mean, we have blood, we have the kills, but you don't go overboard with it.
Don't go overboard.
You know, we don't have buckets of blood filling the hallways in the hospital.
No.
You keep it focused, concentrated. You know,
I wanted to make it more of like a thriller, like more of Scream, in the line of Scream. That they got kills, but they're not like over the top, you know?
And the thing is, with the kills that we have, for most of them, we don't see them coming. And
no.
The one that you would think is coming, like with Nurse Nancy.
Yeah.
Well, she's still running around in her hot pink scrubs.
Yeah.
So, it's, you know, you give us the unexpected here. You know, if we're looking for the expected, like Nurse Nancy to bite the dust, well, Nurse Nancy doesn't.
She doesn't. Nope.
We don't expect Nurse Nancy to, like, be crushing on... the copycat
killer.
Like
I said, that was made at the last minute, but I liked it, so we kept it.
And it just works so well, Jeff.
It did. The way when she came out, she's like, I want to do this, and I want to be caressing, because everybody treats him badly. Well, somebody should treat him good, and I'm like, okay, let's see how it works. And then it works, so I was like, all right, let's keep it.
Yeah. And, of course, now she's, you know, insured that she's going to have future roles.
Yeah, she insured that she's going to have future roles.
She's very savvy that way. Very savvy.
She's trying to get me to do a movie. She wants me, and if we're successful enough with the next few movies, I might do it. She wants me to do a film about her character called Nurse Nancy. So I was like, you know what? Let's flesh out her character over the next few movies and make her a bad guy. So
I could see a Nurse Nancy film with her crushing on all kinds of characters, or she gets moved to a prison.
Yeah, and that's funny you say that.
And she's the prison nurse. And
that's funny you say that, because there's something that's, I'm not going to go into detail, but we got something like that working.
Because I could just see her character falling in love with all these different murderers. And, you know, and then a lot of these convicts, they start turning up dead. Are they killing each other?
Yeah, she was saying that her kills could be more like methodic, like, you know, like she uses like syringes and stuff like that.
But is she doing it? Are they killing each other over jealousy for
her
affection?
That's a good idea. I got to start writing these ideas down and putting us contributing.
I can just see where a Nurse Nancy horror film could go.
Yes.
With what you and Bai have already established. I can just see.
And she's ready to do it. She's really enthusiastic.
I think you just hit the nail on the head for Bai. Is it that enthusiasm? She is enthusiastic about every role that she does.
She is.
Every
she really
red
is.
Carpet that she walks, every interview that she does, she is beyond ebullient and effervescent. She I think she is.
And Felissa, you didn't mention Felissa.
Oh, Felissa. Felissa as the necromancer is...
Yes, she's a necromancer.
She's hilarious, actually.
She's great.
She's hilarious. You know,
she is. I love her character.
Well, on all of your characters, though, Jeff, are really fun, interesting characters. They're very eclectic.
Thank you. When I write, I fall in love with these characters, and so I start writing for them like out of love, you know?
How do you come up with these unique characters? Because these are not the kind of typical characters that you're going to see. I over the course of 42 plus years, I've been a critic. I think this may be the fourth or fifth film where I've done an interview, and actually we're talking about necromancers.
Necromancer.
Which I think is just delightfully fun. But how do you come up with, where do you tap into to come up with these unique characters?
Well, the way I write is I don't sit down and write. I come up with these ideas like over like a period of about a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk to people and they give me ideas. And like the hospital scene, that was Shadow's real experience in real life. The guy who plays the Omicron.
Wow.
And so like, and then like a character like the necromancer, I had another person tell me, you know, we should make a cult and they should try to resurrect the COVID killer. So I was thinking about, I want a female lead. And then I play like a game called Castlevania. And in that game, they had like somebody called the necromancer, because the necromancer means somebody who resurrects somebody from the dead.
Yep.
And then I remember thinking about the Evil Dead movies. They used the book, the Necronomicon. So, like, I pulled it from different places, you know what I mean? I thought, you know, then Felissa Rose came on, I'm like, wow, she would be good, because she's real sarcastic. And I wanted the character to be sarcastic and evil and kind of a jerk, but she's funny, you know?
Mm-hmm. And then the people that you surround her with. her cult, which is just, talk about lame brains.
They're like the Three Stooges, the Six Stooges.
And, of course, then you counter that where you've got neighborhood kids playing in the cemetery, doing kid stuff, and they're smarter than most of the adults that we see.
They are. They're the only ones that almost apprehended the Omicron.
Yeah, they do their whole, you know, kid stuff with running ribbons, running wires, trip and falls, you know, common sense.
I'm a big Goonies fan.
Well,
so, and like Stranger Things, so like I got that from that.
That explains it. You know, it's a Roadrunner thing too. You know,
yeah, Road and right, and Road the Wile E. Coyote. Yeah.
I'm a Wile E. Coyote fan, so
I am too. So maybe that's in my subconscious.
So, but these fun things. And all of it, it's so welcome to see unfold. But now you also, because you do play Brock Callahan, a.k.a. The Flash, Jesus, Jeff. Yeah. Was it always your intention to act in the film?
Yes. And the reason for that was the first film, I didn't act in it. And I had a lead actor. And, well, I was supposed to act in the first film, but then something happened where we had to use it. So the first film, like I said, was extremely low budget. We shot it on a cell phone. So I don't brag too much about it. But it got us to where we're at now, so I have to respect that. But I wasn't supposed to be in that film. Well, I mean, I originally was supposed to be in it, but then I wasn't in it. But then somebody didn't show up for one of the scenes, an actor. So then I end up being a cop in there, like a little minor role.
Mm-hmm.
So then going forward, I said, you know what? I'm just going to play the lead in the next movie. And I took that minor role from the first film and expanded him.
So now, how challenging is it for you? You're wearing multiple hats. You're the writer, you're the director, and you're the actor. How do you go about juggling these hats that you're wearing?
It was hard.
Yeah, is actor Jeff listening to director Jeff? Is writer Jeff crying because director Jeff has to cut some scenes? How did you go about navigating this triumvirate in your head?
Luckily, with this film, I got a bigger crew, so I would relegate those roles to other people. I would ask them, you know, how's my acting? Did I say the line right? Does it sound good? And I'll ask everybody on set, and then I'll take the consensus of what everybody says, you know? And as far as writing go, the night before, I'm always rewriting stuff, always.
Mm-hmm.
We're always extending scenes in beginnings or middle or taking stuff out or adding stuff. But it's hard. It was really difficult because I didn't get time to memorize a lot of my lines, so I had to do them the day of, and then you got to direct. So what I would do is, I was staying the hallway for like maybe a half an hour and start memorizing my lines. But that's why the next film I'm barely going to be in the film. I want to concentrate on the other actors. Crazy Cloudy, I'm going to have a cameo, one scene, and that's it.
Well, in that way, you can really work on honing your directorial skills.
Exactly. And not only that, I want to keep Brock Callahan part of the Omicron series, Crazy Clowny. I don't want to put him in every movie. So I'd rather keep Brock special for the Omicron series. Crazy Clowny will get his own detectives.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and it'll be easy for me to direct.
Now, how important was it having your... Because of the fact you're in a good portion of the film, how important... And you are getting feedback from other people on set based on your performances... But then,
yeah, and I had assistant director too. She helped me.
And I was going to say, how important is your assistant director and your cinematographer in terms of blocking out and shooting these scenes that you are in?
It is extremely important. Without them, I wouldn't be able to do it, like at all. And they were very, very, very detrimental into what we were doing.
You know, and that begs the question. And because you're still writing up until like the night before and things like that, how does that impact the actual overall blocking and lighting for your cinematographer, for Brad?
Brad, it was difficult. Like I said, so the night before, I don't do storyboards, but we have to do
shot list.
Say it again.
Shot list.
We have to do a shot list. So I have to sit up and write every shot. And if I'm in it, I got to make sure that Brad understands what I want beforehand so that he can set up the cameras and the lights. And the assistant director, that was Kiana Sky. And they were really good. So they knew, you know. And I think Brad had a little bit of directing experience, so he could help me out with that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, his big thing is going to be the lighting and the blocking, especially when you get into places like the hospital, like the room.
Yes.
The room is not that big.
No.
You know, your cemetery scenes, the cemetery scene outdoors is really, I really like how that's set up, how that's shot.
Yeah, six days we were there.
Yeah, it's really nice. But then some of your other stuff, like, within the hospital, within some other rooms and things, it gets a little trickier.
Because what a lot of people don't understand is like it's a low budget film, so we're cramped. We don't have we couldn't shoot in an actual hospital. So what we did was we shot in a school, college, right? And in the college, they have a nursing program. So they have hospital replica. The rooms are exact replicas of hospitals, right? But the other side of the room, there's no wall. So we couldn't shoot the fourth wall. So we could only shoot in three directions, not the direction in the other direction. So it limits what you can do, you know?
Absolutely. So where did you shoot this one?
Oh, the hospital scenes?
Yeah.
Fulton Montgomery Community College.
And where? What state is that in?
New York.
Oh, okay.
Upstate.
All right.
You they know, let us shoot the whole school at the hospital. I mean, it was great because, like I said, they have a nursing facility that's an exact replica of a hospital, so it helped us out a lot.
Yeah, it's funny. I've got another film I've got to look at that they also shot in. They shot in Columbus, Georgia, in a school of nursing, using part of that as a hospital.
Get out of here! You serious?
I'm very serious. Very serious.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so I'm really curious to watch that one. I just got the link for it the other day, and I'm going to be speaking with the director.
That's awesome.
But, yeah, you know, you've got to do what you got to do when you're dealing with...
You got to do what you got to do. And we use the exteriors from a real hospital, so it looks authentic.
Mm-hmm. But, no, it very easily, the ugly color paint on the walls, the ugly linoleum floor, it looked like a hospital.
Yeah, we wanted it to look like a dingy hospital, like, because the doctor is a jerk. He's kind of evil, so we wanted it to make it look like a hospital that people don't want to go to.
If I were the Omicron killer, I wouldn't have wanted to be in that hospital.
It's fun. Like I said, people watch the film, and like I said, there's so many like people that like attack him and like. They put him down. They ridicule him. Like even the news people, to the point where you feel like you feel bad for him. Like they wanted him to succeed.
Yeah, yeah. No,
you're rooting for the bad guy.
You know, until he does something. Until you know, you see him kill somebody, then it's
and
like
then you go,
yeah. Now, you know,
he's a bad guy.
How challenging was your editing process on this one? You're working with Austin Nordell.
It really wasn't. I mean, it was tedious, uh-huh. But it wasn't that because Austin Nordell is a master, and I found him from a friend of mine, a composer, and he's so good. Like he took the project. He wasn't a part of like the crew that we were shooting, and he just knows what he's doing. Like he's way more professional than all of us. He has way more experience. Mm-hmm. I think he shot like 50 films and like edited like 70.
Yeah.
So he knew what he was doing. So he really helped me out a lot. Like he gave me, I was learning from him. Like I've edited other films, but with him, it was like editing like a Marvel movie. Like he knew, he gave me like visual effects artists. He gave me people that could help with like the audio, special effects, sound effects. He was great.
Well, and speaking of audio, loving your score, Tasos Eliopoulos.
Thank you. We spent a lot of time on that. I wanted to have a classic score like Halloween or, you know, Mike Jason.
You really, the score is excellent, and you've got shades of those 70s and 80s films happening.
Yes.
Within the score. And some of it, it's not a full score. It's just punctuated sound.
Yeah, because the guy who did he helps with the score, his name is Tasos Eliopoulos. And he does the score, but I go in there and I do kind of my own score. I like remix his stuff. And I grab stuff from Austin that he did. So the score is a combination of Tasos, Austin, me, and Jaime. Jaime's the sound mixer. Sound design guy. So I love music and I love the score. I like scoring things. So I go in there and I fine tune it, you know?
Well, I really like your end result with the score. And I love when we have those significant moments that the timbre of, you know, maybe just three notes that are being held and repeated. Yeah. So it comes across very much as a Halloween.
Like the Omicron, he's got his own theme with Tarnan. I want it to people to remember when they hear that's the Omicron theme and he's coming.
Well, you have it perfectly placed. The motif works really well. It identifies him. So the attention that you paid to it does pay off, Jeff.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So now where can everybody see the Omicron Killer?
Well, right now we just have four screenings and, mm-hmm. and two in California.
Right at the Lemley Monica.
One upstate and one in Brooklyn. The only place that is still playing is in Johnstown upstate. But we might get another showing in April, the last week of April, in Fort Lee, New Jersey. It's not definite, but it's most likely we're going to have a showing in Fort Lee, New Jersey.
So now, will this be available on digital anytime soon, or?
The distributor, they told us it'll be on streaming towards the end of the year. So I'm assuming by Halloween. Because that's when horror movies do well.
One would think that would be the perfect time to get this on the screen.
They're being vague. They just told me by the end of the year. So I'm assuming Halloween, yeah.
But now everybody can follow along the adventures of the Omicron Killer. If they go to the website, I'm sure you're going to be giving updates on there.
Yes.
OmicronKillerMovie.com.
Yes.
And I'm sure we don't have to spell Omicron. Everybody has lived it.
Yes.
Through the pandemic.
They're still spelling it wrong, though, on some sites.
So you all know how to spell it. The OmicronKillerMovie.com. And by the way, I like the site. The site is very catchy.
Thank you.
You know, you log on to that site and that huge imagery hits you right away.
Yeah, I know. I worked on that, yeah.
Oh, my God. It works. You know, when are we going to have another movie from you? When will we get Crazy Clowny?
I'm gonna start writing that actually this week. I have 30 pages of notes. I'm gonna start writing that this week. Hopefully by the end of 2025.
All right. Well.
Yeah.
For my money, everybody needs to be on the lookout for Omicron Killer. It will be a great addition to anybody's horror lineup once it's available to all. And I hope when it goes digital, you'll come back on the show and we can talk more about it and remind everybody about it.
Absolutely.
Oh, Jeff, this has been so wonderful having you on today.
Oh, thank you. The pleasure's all mine.
And I can't wait until we get to chat again.
Awesome. Me too.
Now get to work on Crazy Clowny and, you know, Nurse Nancy.
Yes. Crazy Clowny, Nurse Nancy. Yep.
Oh, Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Jeff Knight, the Omicron Killer, writer, director, actor, producer. So follow along with the film, the website, theomicronkillermovie.com for updates of where it might be screening live, you know, in theaters and for the status of digital releasing. It will definitely be one you're going to want to add to your horror lineup. Now, before we go today, I have to mention my pal, Dave Karger. Most of you know him as one of the TCM hosts. Dave's movie, Dave's book is out. Dave has written a book called 50 Oscar Nights, Iconic Stars and Filmmakers on Their Career-Defining Wins. It is wonderful. I have mine. If you're watching on the AdrenalineRadio.com Facebook page, you'll see it. I have it on the tablescape. I love it. Dave wrote a lovely message to me in the book. He signed it for me. But it's really interesting. A lot of interviews that he's conducted with all of these actors, Nicole Kidman, Elton John, Jennifer Hudson, Spielberg, Scorsese, Rita Moreno, Julia Roberts, Clint Eastwood, Michael Douglas, Francis Ford Coppola, Joel Grey, Meryl Streep. There's 50 interviews in here. Lots of pictures, but you know, Dave has his own interview style, just like I have mine. And Dave loves films, be it classic films, be it new films. And he loves, he truly loves bringing something out in these people. And I'm so happy that he has joined the lineup of authors with TCM, with books through TCM. You can, there's time to get your copy of this before the Oscars on Sunday night. As a matter of fact, you can go Larry Edmonds. Larry Edmonds is the place to buy this book. And Sean will get it packed up, sent out to you post-haste so that you will have it. You can peruse it Oscar night or before then. Compare experiences that you're seeing for this year's Oscar winners with the remembrances of those in the past. It's a great book for all the film fans out there, be it a classic film fan, be it a new film fan. Get it, get it, get it. Dave has done a wonderful job on the book. So that's another literary thing for you. I've been telling you about John Lindstrom's book, his crime thriller. Now you've got a whole thing on Hollywood Oscar winners, movies. So check it out. So that is all the time we have today. I have no clue who I have on next week's show. We've been juggling, trying to see, waiting for one person to get back to me if they can do it. Then I have three other people. So I have no clue who we're having on next week's show. But we will have someone. In addition to, you will hear my interview next week with Mark Bristol on The Accidental Texan. And if I don't have a live body because everybody has an Oscar hangover, you may be getting a whole run of interviews on the incredible Masters of the Air limited series on Apple TV. I am so in love with this series. If you haven't seen it, see it. We've got two episodes left. New episodes air on Friday. The first seven are out now. Two more to go. If you haven't read the book on which the series is based, get it. These are true stories in Masters of the Air. And the series is riveting. Absolutely riveting and heartbreaking at the same time. Because we really get to see into the mindset of these airmen who were there during World War II, going on these bombing missions, and very few coming back alive. So, Oscars Sunday night, check it out. Steve Burton back on General Hospital permanently as of today. Go see, bring him to me. Be on lookout for Accidental Texan on Friday. Air Force One down. Masters of the Air. You got a ton of stuff you can watch. And until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.